Paul Grushkin collects the rock and roll ephemera that others might throw away. Grushkin is an archivist with concert promoter Bill Graham and founder of the Bay Area Music Archives. His new book, The Art of Rock, chronicles rock and roll history through the posters designed to promote rock concerts. The Art of Rock begins with the rhythm and blues posters of the 50s, moves through the psychedelic era, and ends with punk posters from the late 70s and early 80s. The book weighs in at 10 pounds and features nearly 2,000 posters laid out with accompanying text. The Art of Rock took Grushkin 4 years to complete, required some detective work, and a lot of traveling far from his home in San Francisco.
You have to go, oh boy, that person in Philadelphia's got one, and you finally meet up with that person and take a look at their collection and do a lot of photography there, and kind of as the parting afterthought, do you know anybody else in Philadelphia that has some posters? You know, I'm looking for stuff like Aretha Franklin from the early 60s or whatever. Invariably, what'll happen is that people will turn you on to other friends, because rock and roll collecting is fundamentally friends. Outside of the Hard Rock cafes, you know, who are putting tens of thousands of dollars into acquiring, you know, Beatles memorabilia and whatnot, fundamentally, rock and roll collecting is people all across the country who have this tremendous love for this stuff.
You devote a good deal of your book to posters for psychedelic bands. Do you think that poster art reached its high point then?
No question about it. Up to the point of late 1965, when so many people started to gather in San Francisco, the great poster artists, as I believe, was done by the master printers for the black acts. But it was still being done in an old-style form. However beautifully done, however beautifully crafted, it was still a style from the past. And when people started to gather in San Francisco and to really express themselves and convolute and emote and really feel themselves reach out in so many spiritual, emotional ways, artistic ways, it was no surprise that poster art came to the forefront. And therefore, you saw people like Wes Wilson, Rick Griffin, Victor Moscoso, Alton Kelly, Stanley Mouse, all collaborating together or working independently, and week after week after week, you would find a fresh new effort done. I mean, just an extraordinary time.
Do you have a sense of whose idea it was initially? Who were some of the people who had the idea of having these weekly posters and of getting independent artists to do it instead of going to a commercial house?
Well, in the early days of producing rock and roll events, Bill Graham, who had been the manager for the mime troupe, started putting on a number of benefit events. At that point, he was not powerful enough to buy display ads in the Chronicle or the Examiner, and radio certainly wasn't paying a great deal of attention. So what better way than to placard the street?
In a lot of the psychedelic posters, the image is what's really strong, and the printing that actually gives the information about the concert is sometimes pretty difficult to make out.
Yeah. Bill Graham has always laughed about that. He said that he would get so angry. You know, he loved the artist. He always wants to make this clear that he loved the artist. I mean, how could you not? The art was so strong, so wonderfully inventive. But, you know, the artist also got carried away, and Graham would always say, well, why don't you at least put a big old asterisk somewhere in that art so that at the bottom of the poster or on the back of the poster, it would say quite clearly who is playing this next week. But, you know, part of the charm of the psychedelic poster is that people would look at it and their body would almost start to follow the curves of the lettering. There are a lot of stories told about people looking into store windows and looking at these posters and trying to bend around and follow the curves of Grateful Dead and Quicksilver Messenger Service. And that was part of the charm of it. And it became less important almost who was playing at the bill as much as there's another incredible event taking place at the Avalon Ballroom this next week.
Is there a poster that to you is just a perfect example of that kind of poster art at its best?
Oh, no question about it. The poster that became the Grateful Dead's third album cover, known to one and all as Oxamoxowa. Rick Griffin did it for an event at the Avalon Ballroom in 1969. And what Griffin produced for them was absolutely the most brilliant piece of psychedelic art of all time. It has a tremendous technical brilliance. It has an introspection and humor. And it says, in very mysterious ways, over and over again, Grateful Dead.
You've tracked down a lot of people who have collected these posters over the years. How were they first collected? Were people ripping them off the sides of buildings where they were stapled on, getting them from proprietors? How were they first collected?
What's interesting about collecting psychedelic posters is that for the first time, and maybe ever, you had a chance to get a beautiful, unstapled poster and bring it into your home. You see, in the early days, they gave you posters at the Fillmore. Bill Graham actually presented you with a poster on your way home. It's an incredible reception, you know. He couldn't afford to do that after a while. He only gave you a handbill, maybe after 1967 or so. But in the early days, you were given this piece of art to treasure. And I think that that ethic of treasuring your pieces of psychedelic art has persisted to this day. What's so interesting is when you meet up with punk and new wave collectors and how different their vision of collecting is. It's quite different than the psychedelic guys.
Yeah, how so?
Well, I had an interesting experience in going to a woman's home. She had been identified to me as one of the country's premier punk and new wave collectors. And I remember for months and months and months, I'd been dealing with people who preserved their collections, you know, in beautiful binders, you know, or framed their art, or in some way or another, the psychedelic art was a very precious commodity, something to be loved. And here I walked into her living room and she said, "Oh, look at this incredible collection I got." And she started ripping it apart and throwing it in the air. And I was down on my hands and knees, you know, trying to smooth out each piece of tattered paper, you know, looking for gems. Her idea of collecting art was it wasn't precious. It was street art. And she loved it, but her way of putting it together as an assemblage was to kind of maltreat it, to kind of push it around, just the way punks and new wavers were pushing the music around.
A lot of the rock art now is really produced not by individuals, but by through the record companies who hire out. So it's a much more commercial commodity than it was before? Do you think that's
true?
No,
actually, it's been a commercial commodity for as long as we can take it back. You have to illustrate album cover. I mean, an album cover is a physical piece of art that wraps, you know, some vinyl in a package, and that's presented to you as a consumer. And, you know, art has always been something out there to whet one's appetite, you know, to buy it off the rack and take it home. A poster, in some respects, was an extension of that.
You've been collecting rock posters and probably album jackets, too, and other rock memorabilia and ephemera for years. What I found is that there are periods when there's, say, a poster that's mass-produced, everybody has it, and it doesn't seem to have that much significance at that time. But 20 years later, after everybody's thrown theirs out, you realize how interesting it was. Now, you've been saving the stuff during the period that it's mass-produced. Did you ever wonder to yourself, is this worth saving? And have you ever been surprised at the payoffs?
You're never supposed to know at the time what it's going to be. I think that's the magic of it. Our psychedelic poster art, our rock and roll art of the 1950s, even our punk and new wave art of the 1980s, it's worth a lot because it's us. It's the story of our lives. And the fact that many, many years later it can be worth something in a commercial sense and a financial return sort of sense, well, that's wonderful. But I think that a lot of art fundamentally is traded among collectors, people who just love rock and roll and want to be turned on by, you know, other forms of it all the time.
What's something that you've preserved in the past few days? Something that you found that you thought you really should save?
Well, somebody came up to me with an incredible poster. I think it was for the Mutants. And I just fell in love with it. And I think that that's what's always going to be happening to me. I will never see the end of it.
Paul, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, it's been a great pleasure.
Paul Grushkin's new book, The Art of Rock, is published by the Abbeville Press. He spoke to us from KQED in San Francisco.